If you've got your Bibles with you, open them to Genesis chapter 40. Genesis chapter 40. If you do not have a Bible with you or you left yours at home today, we've got some in the book rack that are right in front of you. You can just pull one of those out and open up to Genesis. That's the first book of the Bible, chapter 40. Genesis chapter 40. My voice is just a little thin, a little burnt. I was at the Dodger game last night, and you can imagine, I was screaming loudly along with 56,000 other people and crying loudly, actually, towards the end as we join our brethren, the angels, in postseason nothingness. So it was a very sad but very exciting night over there at Dodger Stadium. And because of that, I actually, you know, in 56,000 people in the stadium, and who sits down immediately to my right? Two guys that are decked out in New York Mets gear. I mean, the guy next to me was actually wearing batting gloves that had New York on the back of them, and he had a New York Mets, and people were yelling at him to take off his shirt. So he pulled his shirt open. He had another New York Mets uniform on underneath that one. And so I was next to a couple of New York Met faithful, and so I had a moral responsibility to yell all the more in their ears. And so I did so, and it did not help our team at all. Anyway, I don't know if this happens to you. I am around weddings quite a bit, right? I'm a pastor. I get to officiate quite a few weddings this year alone. I have officiated 8 or 9 different weddings for people. It's actually a really, really exciting opportunity to get to do that. I get to do a lot of premarital counseling, too. I get to sit down with couples, and I go through a pretty rigorous, those of you that have been through premarital with me would agree heartily that it is a pretty rigorous course of premarital counseling. 7 different sessions. We cover a great deal of material. Because of that, though, because I'm a pastor, I get to be around people that are on just short of getting married and are very excited about their relationship, very excited about getting married. And it's one of the few times in people's lives that probably requires, not absolutely requires, but usually requires a pastor. And so I get to come into contact with a lot of people that maybe don't come into contact with church a whole lot. Well, I had a couple of kids that were in my youth group up north, and they graduated actually right after I had been at the church for just a little while, and they graduated into our college group, which was pastored by a different guy, and they progressed along, and pretty soon they came, you know, the word came to me, so-and-so were married. Okay, we'll call them Sally and Joe, all right? Sally and Joe were, getting engaged. And they were engaged, and everybody was very excited. And I had deep, deep reservations about the two of them getting married. For a long list of reasons, I had some real reservations. But primary of which was that Joe did not have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And I believe that Sally did have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And I know that if Jesus Christ, God Almighty, instituted marriage for us, that at the core of a Christian marriage, Jesus Christ has got to be right there at the center. And when He's not, or when Jesus Christ is not recognized as being the center of a Christian relationship, it can cause great damage to a marriage. It can cause great damage to children. It can cause great damage to generations, literally, down the line. And so I had a lot of reservations. That was not my only one, but I had some other reservations. And so I was confronted. Have you ever had this happen to you, where you feel like you need to say something to somebody? Like, I felt like I needed to sit down with Sally and tell her, I've got some reservations. I've got some things that concern me about your impending marriage to Joe. And so I really wanted to sit down with her and talk to her, but she kind of beat me to the punch. She bounced up to me one Sunday morning, and she began to just exude that excitement that newly engaged couples do. She was just literally like a walking, talking cotton candy, you know, thing in front of me, just sweet as pie and excited and bouncy and all pink and, I mean, just really excited about getting married. And the more she talked, the more fearful I became of saying anything to her. You know, I didn't want to pop her little bubble. And the more she got excited and the more she gave me details and the more she had to say, the further and further away I got, from saying anything to her. I began to kind of justify things in my head. Well, maybe they'll work it out. I was not going to be officiating the ceremony. I knew that. I knew that I did not know them closely enough to do that. And so I figured someone else at the church was going to do it. And maybe they would cover these things, you know, in premarital counseling. That's what it's for, right? You uncover all the stuff that you need to talk about. You go into marriage with your eyes wide open so that you have got some good tools so that you can work on it. And I trusted that that would get accomplished. And so I didn't say a word. Things progressed, and as it turned out, they were going to have a pastor from another church officiate their ceremony, but things fell through. Things fell through with that pastor. And so one of my closest friends, someone that was on my staff, in other words, they worked underneath me on my youth staff, was asked to officiate the ceremony. And unbeknownst to me, that person said yes, that they would officiate the ceremony. And then I found out. And now I was in a real pickle. So I went into Pastor X's office and I sat down with him. And I said, well, you know, I've got some reservations that I need to share with you about Joe and Sally. And I explained myself to him. And guess what the first words were off of his lips? Why didn't you say something to them? Why didn't you talk to them before, at the beginning of this? Because now the train has picked up speed. Now things are really headed in this direction. And now you're coming in here and trying to kind of dump your stuff onto me. Why didn't you say something to them in the first place? You should have said something right from the get-go. See, I'm one of those people. I'm a bit of a people pleaser. I like to have good relationships with everybody. It really makes me uncomfortable to feel like there's any conflict between me and anybody else. It's hard for me sometimes to bring up difficult things. That may seem kind of weird because I'm a pastor. And sometimes many of you have said that I say things when I'm preaching that clearly are directed toward you. Like I actually looked at your life and then I made up a point in my sermon about you. And since I do that, you can't possibly perceive me as being, you know, very non-confrontational, because there are Sundays that you walk out feeling like, you know, I'm a boxer and you had your hands tied behind your back and I just, you know, wailed on you all morning. This, of course, is not true. I do not make up points about you personally. I make up points about me personally often. And sometimes we have things in common. And because of that, because God has really been working on my heart, then God gets to work on our hearts together. And as a family, we kind of walk through this Christian life together. But the fact is, in personal relationships, I have a hard time bringing up things that are kind of delicate, that are difficult. Do you? Do you have a hard time saying those tough things to other people? I think most of us like to think of ourselves as non-confrontational people. I mean, who wants to be known as a really confrontational person? Very few of us really want to be known as, you know, yeah, that person's really rude and confrontational. You know, it's just not what we want to be known as. We want to be known as non-confrontational. We want to be known as a people person. Sometimes the idea of confronting others can be so stressful that it causes us sickness. I've talked to some people that need to talk to their boss about something or need to talk to their spouse about something that's serious and really needs to be said. And they've got themselves so worked up, so stressed out, trying to think of how that person is going to respond and what am I going to say then, and then this is going to happen, and then it's all going to go right down into the tank, and oh, it's going to be a mess. And they're so worked up that they make themselves ill in the process. Sometimes we modify our message. Sometimes we don't say what we really feel we are convicted or that we are supposed to say. Sometimes we keep silent altogether, and it blunts the effects. One of the lessons I've learned in life is that if God gives you something to say, and you don't say it, you will still need to say that thing. You'll just need to say it further down the road, and it never gets any easier. It never gets any easier to say hard things. It's not going to be easier tomorrow. It's not going to be easier a week from now. Your teenager is not going to become more mature magically in 2 weeks, and then it'll be easier to talk to them about this glaring area of their life that you've seen. Your spouse, your boss, your coworker, your friends will be no easier to talk to next week than they are this week. And yet many of us walk around convicted by God, actually feeling like God has revealed something to me, and you know, I should really say something. We'll even say something to a trusted friend. You know, I should really say something to that person. And what do? We say nothing. I had to go back to that couple and sit down with them. And believe me, that was tough. You know what her first question was? Why didn't you say something to me sooner if you had some concerns? Thankfully, I was able to share the gospel, and through their premarital counseling, he actually came to know Jesus Christ. This was the thing that God was at work in and using in their lives. No thanks to me. God just wanted to use me as a tool. He wanted to use me as a messenger. But I kind of refused the job, and like Jonah, I headed out of town. And God dragged me back. They told me, you've got a message to give and I'm not going to let you off the hook. That's kind of what we are confronted with this morning in this story of Joseph. Remember, Joseph started out as a youth, kind of shooting off his mouth to his brothers about dreams that he was having. I say shooting off not in a pejorative way. I have mentioned in the past that I feel that Joseph was arrogant when he was younger. And perhaps it will help to balance that kind of opinion out to say that perhaps he was guileless. Perhaps he was not aware of his own arrogance. Perhaps he was not aware of the things that he said and the way that they affected other people. But the fact is, they affected other people in a very negative manner. And those people were his brothers. And they kidnapped him, threw him into a hole, and then sold him to traveling slave traders that were headed down to Egypt. The Bible makes clear, though, that God was with Joseph, and as Joseph heads into, remarkably, the home of the chief bodyguard of Pharaoh, the head of the local Egyptian secret service, a guy named Potiphar, Joseph's life gets better and better and better. Soon, he is Potiphar's personal assistant. Soon, he is running all of the chores, all of the things that go on in Potiphar's home. It says in the Bible that the only thing that Potiphar worried himself with was the food that he ate. That was how thorough and complete Joseph's assistanthood was in Potiphar's home. But there was a problem, wasn't there? Potiphar's wife falsely accuses Joseph of trying to rape her. Joseph, who is acting in the role of integrity in this entire mess, runs out of the house one time, and she grabs out and grabs his coat and tears it off of him. And we talked about last week that even after he is falsely accused, Potiphar throws him into jail, the king's jail, the jail that is actually probably very close to Potiphar's own home. It would have been perhaps even attached to Potiphar's home. He throws him into that jail, and Joseph finds favor, it says, at the end of chapter 39, in the eyes of the chief jailer, the head guy that's in the jail, and puts everything under Joseph's charge. we pick up in our outlines, number one, letter B. While in jail, Joseph, who's probably around 28, meets two men. You remember, this is the king's jail. So some of the people that are in the king's jail are going to be influential people. They're going to be people of rank, people of status. These are not your ordinary criminals. These are not the murderers and that kind of thing. These are people that have high reputations, that have either offended Pharaoh or done something that has caused them to be thrown into the king's jail. Kind of a holding tank, perhaps permanently even, for people that got onto Pharaoh's bad side. They have both committed some sort of unnamed crime. It says that in verse 2 that Pharaoh was furious with his two officials because of what they have done, although it does not name what they've done. So, because they have offended the king of Egypt, known as Pharaoh, they're thrown into jail. Joseph has the chief cupbearer, there's the one person, and the chief baker, there's our second character, placed under his charge by who? Take a look at verse 3. So he put them in confinement. This he here is Pharaoh. Pharaoh puts them, that's the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, in confinement in the house of who? The captain of the bodyguard. Why, that's our friend Potiphar. In the jail, the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. The captain of the bodyguard, Potiphar himself, puts Joseph in charge of them. And he took care of them, Joseph did, and they were in confinement for some time. In other words, they were in jail for a while. And so these three men are in jail talking to one another, living life together, and Joseph is in charge of them. He is over them. He serves them. He makes sure that they're taken care of, and he makes sure that they follow the rules. And then something for them catastrophic happens. A diagnosis without a prognosis. Number two, on the same evening, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker have different dreams. Top of the next page, and in verse 5. The mystery of the dreams deeply troubles both men. Take a look at verse 5 in the text. Then the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in the jail, both had a dream on the same night. Each man with his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came into them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were dejected. Why? Well, the dreams are so troubling to them that their physical appearance actually appears as though they are sick. Their physical appearance looks as though they are ill. Have you ever talked to somebody that wasn't physically ill, but they were making themselves physically ill because they were so troubled by something that was going on in their lives? That's how they looked. They had that look of deep, deep concern on their faces. Joseph compassionately asks his fellow prisoners, why the long faces? Why do you look like that? What is wrong? Now, he was in charge of them. They were under his authority. And so he had the right to ask them this, but his question is filled with compassion. He does not ignore the condition of the prisoners that are in his charge. Rather, he asks them, why? What are the problems? Why are your faces so sad today? Joseph's selflessness, his compassion, despite his own personal difficulties, unlocked the response of these men. Wouldn't it have been easy for Joseph just to say, you got problems. I got problems. I got kidnapped and thrown out of my own country. I'm far away from home. I don't even know if my family is alive anymore. And then, you know, Potiphar, the guy that runs this jail, his wife is a witch. And she got me thrown in here. She accused me falsely. On and on and on he could go, right? He could just lead with that information. He could just jump right down in the pit and say, man, we are all of us messed up, aren't we? That's not Joseph's response at all. He reaches out to them in compassion, and it unlocks these men. It unlocks them to speak of what is going on in their lives. The men present their dilemma to Joseph. And this is their dilemma. Look at it in verse 8. They said to him, we have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it. Then Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. We have had a dream, but we do not have an interpretation. Egyptians believed that some of their dreams, particularly the ones that they could remember, were messages from God. They believed that the dream world was the place where the gods spoke to you. It was the place where the dead resided, but also a place where the gods could speak to you and give you messages for this life. And so there was a whole science set up, much in the same way that we have chemists or physicists, much in the same way that we have rocket scientists. They had dream interpreters, and they had books, and there was a science to it, and there was a head dream interpreter of the state, and they had a whole bunch of other dream interpreters that worked for them, and they had whole books that would give you relationships. You know, if you dream about a bird, it probably means this. If you dream about bread, it probably means this. It was a whole complex science in Egypt of being able to interpret what the gods were attempting to say to people. So you can imagine, these two men have dreams, and they have them so clearly that they can remember them. They have them on the same night, and they're completely cut off from anyone being able to tell them what they meant. They're completely cut off from the normal interpretation that they felt like they would have enjoyed as the chief cupbearer, as the chief baker in Pharaoh's home. It would be like going to the doctor and getting a diagnosis, you've got cancer, without a prognosis. And this is where it will lead. You've got cancer, it's really all we can tell you. We don't really know what kind it is. We don't really know where it's headed. We don't know what's going to happen to you. That's it. It's like this window of a little bit of insight, but not enough insight to do anything with. Not enough insight to adjust to. It's as though God was speaking to them and they didn't know what to do with it. They had placed their faith in a great deal in that culture in the science of dream interpretation. And so they are extremely troubled. They're racking their brains. It's stressing them out. It's causing them so much consternation that it's all over their faces. No one can interpret what they're saying. And I believe that Joseph's response is telling. In fact, I think in this short little response that Joseph gives us, there is a wealth of information, not only about Joseph, but about how we can be responsive in these same types of situations, because we face this kind of stuff all the time. I mean, I doubt that when you're sitting around the, you know, talking around the water cooler at work or whatever the water cooler is, you know, the copy machine, somebody's desk, going out to Taco Bell, whatever, you know, the water cooler is in your place of business or at school or in your home or whatever. Things like this come up all the time. Situations that each one of us face that require some sort of a response. How many of us this past week, I just found it unbelievable to read the details of what happened back in Pennsylvania with these Amish families and these Amish children that were killed by this lunatic who was deeply troubled. And just that whole situation and how it has played out. I've said to my wife on a couple of different occasions this week, those Amish people are representing Jesus Christ in such a bold and provocative manner that it's beginning to tick off people. People are beginning to get angry for them because they won't. Because they have thrown their lives, literally, into the merciful hands of God. They feel they have nothing else, and so they throw themselves into God's mercy. I look at things like that, and people will ask me, when I'm at Starbucks, when I'm in the line at a fast food restaurant, people will turn to you and say, man, what do you think about that? What? Those Amish, they're just getting taken advantage of. And look at their response. I mean, what would you do? What would you do if that happened to you? I'll tell you what I'd do. I'd get a gun and I'd go and shoot somebody and, you know, and then see, these things are around us every day. The week before, it was Bailey, Colorado. A few years ago, it was Columbine. What's it going to be this next week? And what will you say then? The Bible says that our lives are filled with tragedy. That trouble will visit every single one of us in one way or another. And in such a culture as ours, it's all around us. And in such a culture as Joseph's, it was all around him. God had spoken to these two men. And they had nothing for it. They were just troubled. They were just depressed. They were desperate to know. And Joseph, rather than just say, oh, I can interpret that. I just give it to me. I'll tell you what it means. He says, don't interpretations belong to God? And then he invites them to tell it to him. He immediately cuts right through their culture and he says, interpretations belong to God. Look down here at number 3. This whole point is really centered around this little response that he has. His faithful response to the dream dilemma is powerful, I think, on several levels. First, giving God the credit for interpretation would have been exactly the opposite of Egyptian science. I read quite a bit this last week on what a science this was in the Egyptian culture. A lot of you actually know a great deal about that science because you have actually seen hieroglyphic dream sequences that are played out on the sides of Egyptian pharaoh's tombs. You may not know it. I mean, you may not have connected that that's what you were looking at. But you are actually observing dream sequences. The Egyptian perception of what death would be like for the people that were buried in those tombs are played out in those Egyptian hieroglyphs that many of us have observed. We wouldn't know how to interpret them. We don't totally know what they're talking about. But that was part of the science. They would have these people that were dream interpreters come in and actually draw those hieroglyphs to give these people guidance as they went over to the other side. Joseph was confronting the godlessness of his culture. When Joseph says interpretations belong to God, they belong to God and God alone. When he says that unequivocally, he is just flying in the face of the godlessness of his culture. And I think there's a lesson in there. You don't see Joseph out in front of Potiphar's house picketing. You don't see him protesting his treatment. You don't see him doing a lot of the things that we would observe in our own culture as Christianity that is confronting the culture. Now, I actually don't have a lot of issue with those of you or those of us that picket, that protest, that are out there and vocal. I don't think it probably accomplishes the things that we think it does. But I also don't want to cause any kind of a ruckus or an uproar over that particular. What I am trying to point out here is this. When the culture confronted Joseph, he pushed back. And our question here is that our response? J.I. Packard, in his book, Knowing God, says one of the marks of every Christian in history is that when sin confronted them on a personal level, they would push back against that sin. And they'd say, no. This is what the Word of God says. This is what God says about this or that thing. Are we people, when sin confronts us, when ungodliness confronts us, we push back against it? Or have we been duped into the temptation that Joseph did not give into of just saying, oh, you know, that's just the way you think. I think differently. I believe in God. But I don't want that to offend you, so I'm not going to say anything. See, when ungodliness confronts the godly push back. Not because they want to. Not because it's some burning passion inside of them. Because they represent God in those situations. And because they represent God, they have a deeper moral responsibility to stand up and say something. To make clear in the line at Starbucks, to make clear the way that other people make clear their philosophies on life, to make clear that our lives represent God. Joseph did that. He did that clearly by saying that interpretations belong to God. That would have been crazy in that culture. The chief cupbearer and the chief baker probably looked askance at him. Like, what does that mean? Interpretations belong to God? Now, the chief cupbearer obviously was like, okay, I'll go for it. I need that interpretation. And he begins to share. But before we get there, second, number two under letter A, number three, second, the response shows that Joseph did not resent God for the plight that he was in, but rather was depending on God in faith through all of his difficulties. He was not resentful. It would have been very easy, I think, to look at his circumstances and find resentment. I mean, I get resentful when my wife doesn't let me watch ESPN because, you know, there's chores to be done. And I'm like, I have to get married 12 years ago, have two kids and a loving wife and a house. I'm ticked, you know? Because I got to go mow the lawn because I promised her I'd do it last week. I want to watch my ESPN. So mad the Dodgers lost too. But anyway. See, I give in to the simplest of things. I can't imagine if I was falsely accused and thrown in jail that I would not be appealing to you and everyone else that had ears. Look at how I've been taken advantage of! And I just don't see that in Joseph. I see him saying, this is where God has me, and this is where I will serve Him. To have that kind of attitude, to have that kind of perspective, that the will of God for your life is simply to obey Him right where you're at, in whatever life circumstance you have right now. Man, I could just stop right here and just say, okay, let's just chew on that. But of course, Joseph, he's got more going on. Third, Joseph's response shows, I think, a God reflex. His response is immediate. When they say, we've got a dream that has no interpretation, he says, I've got a God that does. It's immediate. He puts God right on the line. His response is not one of sympathy. Oh man, I feel sorry for you. It's not one of empathy. Oh, I've had that happen to me too. His response is one of, my God can provide what you need. It's a God reflex. How you respond in the heat of the moment reveals the heart. The old illustration, you know, of the crusty old carpenter that offered to put up a bulletin board in the pastor's office. So he built it for him, and he made it in such a way that the nail holes would be very, very difficult to nail in. And when he brought it over to the pastor's office, rather than offer to nail it in himself, he simply held the board and gave the nails and the hammer to the pastor, and he said, you go ahead and nail it in. His goal was to have the hammer, was to have the pastor hit his thumb with the hammer so that he could watch the pastor's reaction. That seems funny, doesn't it? It seems kind of odd, like he's setting up the pastor for failure. But the truth is, the way that we respond in the heat of the moment reveals what our hearts are like. And that can be very deflating to say that, because I would bet that even this morning, some of us did something that was the equivalency of banging our thumb with a hammer and yelling out or saying something that we regret. Or at least we should regret if you've gotten over your anger. You will get to regret eventually, hopefully today. And so that can be very deflating, I think, for us. As I was pondering that, I thought, you know, I don't want people to walk out feeling guilty, manipulated, deflated. But I cannot avoid the truth of the statement that the way we respond in the heat of the moment when we are confronted with some action that is opposite of what we expected or is challenging to our faith system, which is exactly what Joseph was confronted with, was an invitation to dive into the Egyptian way of handling things. The way we respond in those moments, frankly, reveal our heart. And there is no way around it. If God has shown you recently, as He has shown me, that my reaction in certain situations is less than a godly reaction, don't walk away guilty. Consider it a gift from God. He has actually shown you, in a very compassionate manner, exactly the area of your own life that you can be working on. But be faithful and have courage to respond in a way that says, something in my heart is wrong. Something in my heart is broken. And I'm going to listen to the voice of the Lord because that thing about me needs to be changed. I need to become a different person. I need to be transformed from the inside out. Because what's in my heart, it's ugly. What's in Joseph's heart was good. His response is a God reflex. Fourth, Joseph trusted that God would reveal the truth of the cupbearer and baker's dreams. You notice that he doesn't stop and say, just a second, let me check this thing out with God. He just has faith in God. It's his reaction that God will provide. It's his response that he knows a God that knows how to interpret. He has no guarantee, but he lived by faith in God. He puts God's name on the line. Faith is not expressed in what we know God will do. You can pray for the sun to come up tomorrow, and then you can marvel with your friends at how good God was to you because the sun came up. But I doubt that anybody will be terribly impressed because God's done that a whole bunch of times without you even asking. It's something that God does. It says that God holds the very firmament together by the force of His own will. That's what God does. We know that there is a future in the Bible, and so you know the sun's going to come up. If you are asking God for things that you know for sure He's going to deliver, that is not very much faith. Faith is expressed in what we have to depend on God to gift us to accomplish. Faith is expressed in what we must depend on God. In other words, we have to have faith in Him that He will give us the gifting to accomplish whatever is going to happen. When you think about the difficult things of your life, perhaps it's your money, your budget, perhaps it's your marriage, perhaps it's your family, your job, schooling, whatever that thing is, are you asking God for things that only He could accomplish? Are you asking Him to give you the gifts that only He could give you? Not something you could figure out, not something that you could work hard at and accomplish of your own strength and your own will, but something that only God could provide. There is no guarantee in that kind of living. But that is faith. Remember the response that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will eventually give in the book of Daniel? Nebuchadnezzar says, I'm throwing you guys into the fiery furnace. You guys are going to be burned alive inside of there. I'm firing that thing up right now. I'm heating it up so hot, you won't live even for a moment. And I'm throwing all three of you in. And what does Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say? We might die, we might live, but God is God, and we are not bowing down to you. Just because we die in a fiery furnace doesn't make it right to bow down to you, Nebuchadnezzar. See, faith is expressed in doing those things that we must depend on God for. That's how faith is expressed. And don't forget, in Hebrews, I'm forgetting the chapter. I think it's Hebrews 11. It is. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. This is not an option for the Christian life, it is a requirement. And what you are seeing Joseph do is live his life by faith. His automatic reaction is, God will do it. God will provide. He'll be there for us. Finally, Joseph's response revealed his faith that God is in control of all of life's circumstances, including implicitly his own dreams. Remember, there are dreams that are dangling here. There are dreams that at the beginning of his life that have not been fulfilled, and we don't know how that's going to turn out. To live that the way that Joseph did, you know, we know what happens, right, at the end, which kind of takes the pop out of the beginning. But don't forget, in the story, it's kind of like these little bookends. Joseph's living his life, and he's got these two dreams hanging over the beginning, back with his brothers and his mother and father, and nothing's happened to him. Like, those haven't been fulfilled. And he's expressing that God is the interpreter. God is the one that makes these things happen. He's expressing that there are dreams in his own life that are still unfulfilled. There's an underlying tone, a thread that runs through the story, that there are dreams that God will still accomplish in Joseph's life. And I believe there are dreams in our lives that God has yet to accomplish. But we must show faith. We must be the faithful people that God can work in and through in order for Him to accomplish the dreams that He has for our lives. I know you have a set of dreams for your life, but God's dreams are better. And if God is to fulfill His dreams in His people, in His way, God calls on us to be faithful. He calls on us to let go of our own reflexes, to let go of our own the things that we put our faith in, to let go of the guarantees, and to place ourselves, our whole lives, in His hands. So the cupbearer takes a step out in faith. Verse 9 says, based on what Joseph said, "So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph. And he said, 'In my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. And as it was budding, its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes. Now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes and I squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand.' And then Joseph said to him, 'This is the interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. Within three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office. And you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer.'" Now that's a good interpretation. I mean, you've been in jail for some time. You've been down in this hole. You've had a dream. And this guy just told you all is well. In 3 days, you're the cupbearer again. Probably the most trusted servant in all of Pharaoh's court, right? The cupbearer, remember what he does? You probably don't. Anyway, the cupbearer is the guy that sipped a little bit of the juice or the wine or whatever was being given to Pharaoh to test it for poison. Kind of a bummer job, actually, but it was very trusted because if you could convince the cupbearer to kill Pharaoh, it was very easy to kill Pharaoh at that point because the cupbearer himself would poison the drink. So the cupbearer was a close relationship. So whatever he did to offend Pharaoh, that's bad. You don't want to be a cupbearer that hacks off your boss, so to speak. So the cupbearer is going to be restored to his position, and that's what he's just been told. The cupbearer shares his dream, and I want to point out one thing that he said to him. There's a play on words in here that's important in Hebrew. Joseph provides the cupbearer with a favorable interpretation of restoration. He will lift up your head. There's another phrase that comes up a little later, and it's kind of different. So, knowing that the chief cupbearer will return to his place of trusted influence, Joseph pleads his own dilemma of being taken or kidnapped from his family and being thrown into prison falsely in the hope for release from Pharaoh. This is an odd and actually a little bit of an ambiguous statement that he makes here, but he simply says, and we can follow it in verses 14 and 15, "Keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do to me a kindness by mentioning to me, by mentioning to Pharaoh about me, and get me out of this house. For I, in fact, was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews. And even here I have done nothing that they should have put me into this dungeon," or literally this hole that he is in. He appeals to the cupbearer. And we will get back to what happens with that in a moment. But the chief baker, verse 16. Chief baker hears about this favorable interpretation. He's like, "All righty, let's get another one going. Let's get another good interpretation." So the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably. And he says to Joseph, "I had a dream also. In my dream, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. And in the top basket, there were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. And the birds were eating them out of the basket that was on my head." And Joseph, and I'll note here without hesitation, all right, Joseph gives him this interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. All is well so far. Within three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you. Now, that's a little hard to read in English, but I'll explain what that means. "And will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off of you." Like, everything came off the tracks for the chief baker at that moment. Everything was good. In fact, the shock of what he has to say to him literally comes at the very, very end. The phrase that he uses with both the cupbearer and the baker are exactly the same. Pharaoh is going to lift up your head. But because of the surrounding context, because of the other words that are around it, what he actually says to the chief cupbearer is, Pharaoh is going to lift up your head and you will be able to serve him his cup. And what he says to the chief baker is, Pharaoh is going to lift up your head and then he's going to take it off of your shoulders. That's brutal. In other words, to the one he says, he will lift up your head. To the other, he says, he will lift off your head. There's even a picture there that he is going to impale his head by taking it off. Joseph's interpretations, and here's the, I think, a compelling point of why this chapter is in the Bible. Joseph's interpretations are given faithfully, letter D. He never mixes the message with the messenger. You don't see him apologizing to the baker before explaining it to him. You know, I'm really sorry I got to tell you this, but he just gives it to him straight. He's faithful to delivering the message despite the consequences of the response. He speaks the truth. He does so in a voice of love, as it says in Ephesians 4. When we do the same, we will never regret it. See, God has given you a message. A message of what He's done in your life. He's given you a message to speak to one another. Those of you that read the Word of God, you're given a message on a continual basis of truth that the whole world needs to know. Your children need to know it. Your spouse needs to know it. Your co-workers need to know it. The whole world needs to know the message of God. But oftentimes, we as Christians feel so embarrassed to say a word, we fall silent. We're not faithful to be the messenger. And we don't feel like we're Jonah. We don't feel like we're running for the hills. But understand that God has a message for you and I to share. And He fully expects us to say something, to show faith, to live in a way that expresses to God that His message in our lives is the most important thing for the world that is around us. Is that true in your life? Has God given you something to say? Has God given you something to say to someone? Has God given you something to say to others? And you have covered your mouth. You have said nothing. You have preferred to walk the line of a people pleaser. Someone who will kind of blunt what they have to say or soften it up a little bit to where it couldn't possibly offend anybody. The Word of God, it says, is going to be offensive. The message of the gospel is clearly offensive. If we think that it is anything less, then we've gotten the message wrong. Joseph shows us an example of being faithful. He was faithful to give the good interpretation or the favorable interpretation. He was faithful to give the unfavorable interpretation. You don't see Joseph getting any great glee out of either one. Rather, he just gives them. All that Joseph speaks of comes to pass, just as the interpretations had predicted. Verses 20 to 22 detail that. However, the cupbearer, verse 23, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Forgot him by choice. He'll remember Joseph eventually someday. Forgot him perhaps because he was a foreigner. Forgot him perhaps because he got what he wanted. He got out. Why push his luck, right? I mean, he just got back. He doesn't need to rock the boat or anything. Forgot him because he had nothing that he owed to a fellow prisoner. What's the message there? Man has abandoned Joseph. But don't forget, God has not. God is at work. And Joseph knows it. that no matter what his circumstances, he is going to serve God with all of his heart. There are very few sermons that have got so much in them in the response of Joseph. There are very few times that we're going to encounter his life where we are going to see him respond in such vivid terms that will connect to who we are. There are very few times that we will be confronted so obviously on the message that we carry to one another and to the world, in our reactions and responses to what happens around us, to whether or not we are living our lives by faith or in a faithless manner, that confront the actual situation that we find ourselves in our marriages, in our relationships, in our work, in our lives. And we are confronted with, what am I saying? How am I reacting? What am I doing that represents living for God for the world that is around me? So this morning, and I'd like to invite the worship team back up. This morning, as the worship team is playing this magnificent hymn, would you consider in your own heart where God is confronting you? See, God did not write the pages of Scripture just so we could all walk away and go, man, that is a really nice story. I think I'll convert that into felt board and teach it to children. That's not like the whole reason that we do things in the church. God has given this to you and I so that it would penetrate our hearts and so that it would change the substance of who we are. Because God also does not want us to walk away feeling manipulated or guilty. He is calling us into a deeper walk and relationship with Him. And He is showing us examples of faith. He is showing us examples of living for Him that will really cause change and make a difference. Do you have a message that you've been silent about? God will not let you off the hook. He is calling you into opening your mouth, into speaking the truth, into speaking the Word in a way that the world can understand. He's calling you to a life of faith that only He can accomplish. And we will give Him the glory for it. Let's stand together and let's worship Him.